Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Today, we're talking about a disorder that directly affects almost 3.5 million people and impacts many more indirectly, meaning family members, spouses, co-workers, friends. We're talking about New Hope for People with Bipolar Disorder. It's a collaborative work of psychiatrist Dr. Fawcett, psychologist Dr. Golden, and bipolar survivor Nancy Rosenfeld. And we'll be looking at the latest breakthrough research. We'll be looking at proven methods for managing your life and your work, new medical strategies, and new precautions. In other words, why some patients get worse rather than better when taking antidepressant medicine. So let me bring on my two guests that are joining me today. With us today, we have Dr. Bernard Golden. He's been a practicing psychologist for 30 years and is the founder of Anger Management Education and the author of two other books. And also joining us, we have Nancy Rosenfeld. She calls herself a bipolar survivor, and she's the author of several books and speaks regularly at bipolar conferences across the country. And the third member of the collaborative team is Dr. John Fawcett, who's not with us today, but he's professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico. He shared the Falcone Prize for research on depression and suicide, and he's the author of seven books and a mental health consultant on The Oprah Show. So, Dr. Bernard Golden and Nancy Rosenfeld, welcome both to the show.
Thank you, Vicki. I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're pleased to have you here, and pleased to find there's new hope, always. This book first came out in 2000, I believe, and you just revamped it with the latest and greatest information at the end of 2007. And we hear such a lot about bipolar disorder today, and on the surface of things, it looks as though it's more prevalent. But we have to ask, are we getting better at diagnosing bipolar? Are we too quick to assign the label bipolar disorder? Or is it simply getting more media attention and therefore we're more open to talking about it? Dr. Golden, why don't you kick off on that?
I'll say yes to all of those, and let me clarify what I mean by that. Previously, bipolar disorder is a kind of an umbrella term, and there were some forms of it that weren't labeled bipolar disorder because there are certain variations with less severe symptoms or less frequent symptoms. Increasingly, people are being diagnosed even with these sub-threshold diagnoses. I think some people may be diagnosed and don't warrant the diagnosis, and at the same time, we're still underdiagnosing.
We're still underdiagnosing?
For a variety of reasons. People aren't getting to therapy. It's not being recognized. The stigma attached keeps people from seeking and finding the appropriate treatment. Very often in psychiatric care, people see their primary care physician rather than a psychiatrist who has more extensive experience. That might be another factor that keeps people from getting the appropriate treatment.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's also quite difficult to diagnose. There's no definitive test. It's really, I was watching a Frontline documentary on it a couple of weeks ago, and every specialist on there said it's really, it's best guess as far as once they've got, eliminated certain issues. Is that your point of view on that?
So much of diagnosing bipolar disorder is a collection of history, events over several years. And so sometimes a clinician may see certain symptoms that are currently being expressed or evidenced and not get a full history. Either the client themselves don't remember or forget, or our family members are not available to give it. So it often takes several years to actually get a diagnosis.
Mm. Now, Nancy, you describe yourself as a bipolar survivor.
Correct.
When did you first notice that something was wrong enough that you wanted to seek out the answer to what the problem was?
Yes. Well, I had a very normal childhood. I come from a typical middle-class suburban American community, and it wasn't really until the early 1980s that I first exhibited the first signs of bipolar disorder. Let me also say, Vicki, that it is very often genetic. And I have it on both sides of my family, so I suppose I could say I'm twice blessed.
Mm-hmm.
But I became, in the early 80s, very involved as a political activist, and I was campaigning to help rescue Soviet Jews. This was this work was extremely exciting. And I experienced just unbelievable highs and lows. It was like a roller coaster of highs and lows and back and forth. But still, I did not recognize it because I was so busy with my work for several years. And when you're on a high, you don't know, because you feel that you're very efficient, that you're omnipotent, you're working at the maximum level of your capabilities. It's not until something happens and you take the plunge that you are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what happened to me. The first time I plummeted was in 1987, when it suddenly occurred to me that my work was over and I hadn't really prepared myself for the next step in my life. And I suffered a breakdown. And that was the first time I went to a therapist. But not until I rebounded from that. It took me a while, but I rebounded. But then in 1994, I had a great big break. And this was after I had finished writing my first book, which was on the subject of rescue. And that was also very exciting. That actually helped me get well from the 87 episode. And after I was finished writing the book and I was finished touring because of the book, it suddenly dawned on me, it must be the swan song for books. And I
right.
had a terrible crash. And the second crash is always worse than the first. And at that moment, I felt like I had scaled the Mount Everest and had just plummeted to the bottom of hell. And I had a suicide attempt. And that's when I was taken to a psychiatrist, and it took a while, but it was ultimately diagnosed as bipolar disorder, and it normally takes 6 to 7 years for an accurate diagnosis.
Hmm. So, Dr. Golden, from your perspective, what do you look like when a patient comes to you and says, you know, I think I might have bipolar disorder? What kind of things do you look for specifically?
There's a specific mood change, and both in terms of judgment as well. For example, mania, with extreme mania, there's extreme optimism, self-confidence that's often inflated, decreased need for sleep without fatigue, grandiose delusions sometimes, also increased irritability, agitation, rapid speech, poor judgment.
Mm.
That's during the mania. And then followed by mania, it's often after mania, the person experiences a period of depression, and that's evidenced by depressed mood, loss of appetite, decreased or increased need for sleep for some, motivation is decreased, fatigue, also helplessness, worthlessness. Physical agitation may be accompanied by the depression and thoughts of suicide as well.
Okay. Now, you mentioned grandiosity and, you know, feelings of overconfidence. If somebody has bipolar, do they recognize those traits themselves?
There are various levels of mania. So someone who has bipolar 1, the more severe, may have grandiose delusions where there's a disregard for law, disregard for more rational reasoning, problems in driving, for example, violation of law, spending money that's well above their means. So they don't recognize it.
Mm.
They become so focused on whatever their goal is at those times. Lower mania, a person may recognize it, but say, hey, this is wonderful.
And that's called, is that what's called hypomania, lower, when you say lower mania?
Hypo, right.
So they still have that really strong work drive, but without all the grandiosity attached. Is that how that
works? Right, with severe grandiosity. Also in terms of psychotic behavior, more extreme bipolar 1 may have psychotic behavior, whereas bipolar 2 is a less severe dose.
Okay. Vicki, if I may jump in, I could cite a couple of examples of hypomania.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working on my second book, the one that preceded the New Hope books, I was working with a co-author, and at one point, I was speaking with her, and it was quite obvious that I was manic. Let me quote from my co-author, from just as much a woman, and the quote is in this book, New Hope. Nancy is speaking louder and faster. Her voice is strident. The sweetness gone. How does she have time to breathe between words? She accuses me of being critical of her. I feel I am not being heard. In frustration, I put down the phone and walk away. When I return a few minutes later, Nancy is still talking. She did not even notice my absence.
Right, right.
And it's like, wow.
Now,
that really is frightening.
Yeah, when that happened, Nancy, were you aware you were just totally oblivious of this?
No, I wasn't aware at all. And another episode that I can tell you quite differently, it was in the early years of my rescue work, and I was monitoring a 40-day hunger strike of the Soviet scientists that I ended up helping to rescue on an international basis, which was very exciting. And I remember that my husband walked into the room, as I had put down the phone, and he said that our younger son needed help with an English assignment. He said, "Nancy, you're the writer in the family. Would you help him?" And I looked at him as if, what are you talking about? I felt, on two different planets. How could I relate to an English assignment? I said, an English assignment? I'm monitoring a 40-day hunger strike. I could not, Vicki, make the connection.
Mm-hmm.
I could not make the transition. I was totally wrapped up in what I was doing, to the exclusion of everything else and everyone else around me, particularly my family.
Mm. One of the things that surprised me when I was reading the book was who it affects, because I just assumed from things that I'd heard that, you know, bipolar is genetic, and for the most part, and so you had it from birth, but it actually, incidences can come out much later in life, in the 40s and 50s, is that correct?
Well, that's right, and it normally takes something to kick it in. And as I think I mentioned earlier, I had a very, you know, normal childhood. I had my typical normal ups and downs like any other child, and I had I'm happily married, although I must say that during my intensity, during my involvement with Soviet rescue, my marriage for a while was on the rocks. I don't know how anybody could live with me. But it takes something to kick it in. And for me, what kicked it in was the roller coaster ups and downs of the entire rescue effort, because I spearheaded the rescue of a former Soviet scientist on an international basis, and Alan Dershowitz from Harvard was the attorney, and this was all very exciting. And at the end of several years, we won, and I was sent to Vienna to meet the plane coming in from Moscow, and the European press was there. I mean, it was very, very exciting. And this is what I did day in and day out for more than 5 years.
Mm. And suddenly that all ends.
Suddenly it's all over. And it was so exciting. CNN covered it. It was so exciting that, yes, I hit a huge fall twice.
Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to look at some of the biological factors and some of the emerging therapies that are offering new hope for people with bipolar disorder. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Be sure and tune in next Monday at noon when Vicky talks to Julie Matthews. Julie Matthews is committed to health, healing, and the happiness of all things. Her latest work is the accumulation of 7 years of study into the impact of food and environmental toxins on the health and brain function of children. Tune in for Nourishing Hope next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. For more information, see conversationslive.net.
Hi, everyone. I'm Buzz.
And I'm Robin, reminding you to catch The Living Life Show Thursdays at 2 p.m. right here on KKNW.
The Living Life Show is your weekly guide to living life better both at home and away.
Each week, we bring you interesting guests and industry experts who share their tips for your home and your vacations.
We even have some great recipes for you to try, and you can even see us make them on our website.
You bet. So be sure to listen Thursday at 2 p.m. to The Living Life Show right here on KKNW.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural, alternative talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. We're talking today about New Hope for People with Bipolar Disorder. It's a collaborative work of Dr. Fawcett, who's a psychiatrist, Dr. Golden, who's a psychologist, and bipolar survivor Nancy Rosenfeld. And we have Dr. Golden and Nancy Rosenfeld talking with us today on this subject. And I wanted Dr. Golden to look at some of the biological factors. In the book, you raise a question. You say, we might ask ourselves just what in our culture is producing the increased incidence of mental disorders and agitating genetic vulnerability. So I wonder if we could talk a little about that. Just what is producing that increased incidence of mental disorders in our society?
Well, as you emphasize, there is a genetic predisposition. And what research is finding that for so many behavioral patterns that we fall into, by predisposition, meaning that, well, you may have a genetic factor there, but there are some experiential events in our lives that can trigger them. Many times, a person might have a genetic predisposition. Early childhood trauma might trigger it. Use of drugs and alcohol, increasingly there are studies that link the two. Stressors, the examples that Nancy described, stressors in one's life can also exacerbate that genetic
I also saw in the book that you said since the 1930s, research suggests that changes in the agricultural business have reduced our sources of omega-3 fatty acids, and that's had some impact on the increase.
Some of the studies of omega-3 for bipolar have shown some gains in the mood disorder. Others haven't. But there are different research going on in terms of what are the nutritional factors that contribute to it.
Okay. Well, so what kind of studies are being done right now on nutrition, and what do we need to know? What does somebody with bipolar need to know about nutrition?
Well, things that affect our energy level in general. For example, every time I see a client, I will ask them, do you drink coffee? Mm-hmm. So what are the impacts of caffeine? Some look at issues regarding B12 and some other vitamins or deficiencies. So they run the gamut.
So pretty much what the rest of us have to worry about, too, just good health, good nutrition. I noticed in the book that one of the ways you say people stabilize their condition, and Nancy probably answered to this too, is, you know, get plenty of rest, have plenty of routine and structure in your life, have good relationships.
One of the major studies that have been very effective in the last few years is emphasizing a psychotherapy that is really based on routine, for example.
Mm.
Just as we take a flight, we have jet lag when there's a disruption to our sleep routine. I think people with bipolar disorder increasingly find that there's a need for a sleep routine, timing the meals, timing even social contact, and that the vulnerability to a change in these routines can be a precipitant.
Okay, let's look at some of the emerging therapies that are coming out. Nancy, have you had psychotherapy along with your medication?
Yes, I had extensive psychotherapy for the first few years, and I'm not under. I'm not in therapy anymore, but I do take my medicine daily. I wouldn't be without it. But it, for me, the writing of this book was a tremendous, tremendous, it helped me heal, because writing is so cathartic. And when the opportunity presented itself to write a book on bipolar disorder, that became my ultimate challenge, to take charge of the illness that had nearly destroyed my life. And I always feel, Vicki, that I'm in such good company, because I'm sandwiched in between two doctors, Dr. Fawcett, the psychiatrist, and Dr. Golden, the psychologist. And,
right.
And how can I go wrong? And we collaborated on these books for years, and we're still in very, very close contact. But as a researcher, when I researched for many years, bipolar and what triggers it and my condition, that was enormously helpful. And actually, that is also one of the things that we recommend to people, that they take charge of the illness, and that they educate themselves, and that their families educate themselves, because this is extremely important. It's just as important as your support system.
Right, right.
And for a bipolar patient, for any patient, it's very, very important to have a very strong support system. So education, and for me, it was educating myself through the book, that education is just of paramount importance, as is a very solid support system. You've got to get everybody involved.
Right.
And psychotherapy and medication therapy. And Dr. Fawcett is involved in many, many of these new therapies. And he has the, he's so up on everything that's coming out today, tomorrow, the next day.
Right. Let's talk about some specifics then. And I don't know who wants to answer this. Jump on in, Dr. Golden, if you think you can best answer this, or Nancy. But I saw an article in the New York Times last year which said that cognitive behavioral treatment is actually having a better impact on some bipolar patients than the medicine itself. Are you familiar with those studies?
I saw those, yes. Cognitive behavioral therapy is probably the most thoroughly studied of psychotherapies. It dates back 20-something years. At the same time, there's been a real evolution in terms of cognitive behavioral therapies, too. Therapies that focus on some of the specific issues dealing with bipolar disorder. For example, cognitive therapy, briefly described, is helping to recognize and identify how our thoughts influence our emotions. So someone has a thought immediately that's self-critical, or I'm depressed, they may relate and react with, I'll always be depressed. Oh, it must be my bipolar disorder. And cognitive therapy helps people better understand that we are not our thoughts. Just because we have a thought doesn't mean it's true. Helps them develop other thoughts to counter that.
Okay.
One of the issues that I think is really a struggle for many people with bipolar disorder is realizing that they are not the disorder, meaning they have an identity that is separate and apart from the disorder. And so through therapy, cognitive therapy, they're helped to better understand that they have a personality long before they may have their first episode. And their whole view in that personality with dealing with suffering, dealing with the challenges of life, is very much reflected. Some client, for example, I saw one time said, I don't want to deal with this. She was so focused on the stigma that was attached to it. I don't want to see myself like some of those people on TV I see, who like Britney Spears or others. And what she is saying is, I don't want to accept the disorder I have. That is too frightening, too scary. And that her whole identity, she felt, would be consumed by it.
Mm.
So these therapies are what's called behavioral activation therapy. Rather than looking internally at some deep-rooted emotions that are going on, for example, a client of mine sleeps in on Saturdays and she hesitates to wake up because she knows she has to clean the kitchen table. And so one way of looking at depression is that at the moment we're making a cost-benefit estimate. Will there be a benefit in my getting up to do this? And so because of severe depression, the answer is no. Mm. So what I help people do is to look at, okay, if you decide to go back to bed, at the end of an hour, are you going to feel better or worse about yourself versus get up and do one-fourth of that kitchen table and then go back to bed for a while? So it's incrementally helping people seeing that we're making decisions, that during depression we're making decisions about thinking that is non-rational.
Okay. And one of the therapies that is new and emerging is acceptance and commitment therapy. What does that entail?
In many ways, it emphasizes that we begin from where we're at. I talk about acceptance of the disorder. Before someone could really be open to change, accepting that this is a challenge they have to live with. And that's part of the acceptance, that these are feelings and emotions and even thoughts that will visit them periodically. It doesn't define who they are. Acceptance and commitment therapy also, unlike some of the other therapies, help clients realize what is it they are valuing in life. What is their personal commitment to life in terms of mission? What do they find meaningful? And then the therapy then focuses on, okay, what would you be doing, as an example, if you weren't depressed, what would you like to be doing? If you are feeling mania, what is it you want to achieve? So on one hand, it's helping them accept some challenges and limitations, but also helping them focus and help really intensify the nature of the recognition of the goal.
Mm.
And then the commitment is helping clients monitor during this past week what got in your way, what fostered you moving toward your goal. So unlike some of the other therapies, it's value-directed.
Okay. And then the other one I wanted just to bring up on the show, because this is another emerging therapy, is dialectical behavioral therapy. I've never heard of dialectical behavioral therapy, but you say in the book it's a derivative of cognitive behavioral therapy, and it integrates more traditional aspects of cognitive mindfulness, social skills. How does that work?
This is it borrows from a variety of therapies, and it was initially for many years focused on the suicidal clients, helping them become more calm physically, helping them to see that some of the anxiety or the suicidal thought was going on at a specific moment in time. And so the integrative approach is they use mindfulness skills, for example, whereas cognitive therapy says, let's focus on challenging your thoughts. DBT emphasizes mindfulness, which says, just be aware you're having that thought. You don't have to act on it, that your brain or your mind is just, in a sense, sending this thought out. But you be an observer. It's there, rather than responding to it. DBT also emphasizes recognizing the emotional triggers or reactions that trigger negative emotions and becoming more aware of this is a self-critical thought. Assertiveness skills is a very strong factor that a real stress management technique is saying no. So a part of the focus is helping people to do that.
To learn to say no, which we all need to do from time to time, right? So my question then, I guess, is with this therapy, it's kind of that chicken and the egg thing, you know, what comes first, the thoughts or the behaviors or the feelings? But if somebody's in a bipolar state, I guess if they're in a manic state or a severely depressed state, do they have the wherewithal usually to be able to put that into a cognitive context and think things through rationally?
During for example, bipolar 1, where hospitalization is often indicated, the depression is too severe or the anxiety is too distracting to focus on the therapy, so medication is a major part of treatment.
Okay.
Then once that intensity is diminished, then the therapy can be beneficial.
Mm. And so let's talk about medication. And what are you on, Nancy, if you don't mind sharing
that? I'm on Zoloft, Vicki. I was diagnosed during the height of a very, very serious depression. So I was immediately put on an antidepressant, which is Zoloft. And that's what I take. I don't take anything other than this one medication for it.
Okay. And so what are some of the emerging medications that we're seeing coming out and being successful right now?
Increasingly, and one of the reasons that the book was rewritten again was just in the last 10 years, there have been a number of anti-epileptic drugs that have been found to be helpful in terms of managing mood disorder. Same thing with some of the antipsychotic medications. And a new host of antidepressant medications have been used.
Okay, and so are they still using, is lithium still the predominant one, or?
It still is used, and for many patients that is still pretty much the major one. It should be emphasized that very infrequently is one medication used. It's always, in a sense, a cocktail, several medications that are used
right
at the same time.
Yeah, and Nancy said earlier it can take about 7 or 8 years to get a proper diagnosis on bipolar disorder. Since you can't measure any of the elements in the brain like that, how do you come up with a dose and a medication that works? A lot of it's trial and error, right, and commitment with the patient.
A lot of it is exactly trial and error. I emphasize to clients that they can have someone same height, same weight, same age, and yet their body chemistry is significantly different. And what's needed and emphasized and important is that client communicates with the therapist, psychiatrist, some of the effects they're experiencing, what seems to be working, what doesn't, and encouraging them to recognize that it does take time to actually identify what is the best medication.
Yeah, and Vicki, it might be interesting for the listeners to know that in the book, we have a series of PET scans. These are colored pictures of the book of the brain, excuse me. And we show the depressed brain, and then we show the recovered brain. We also show the rapid cycling manic depressive brain after so many days, and we have. Actually, we have 9 pictures of the rapid cycling manic depressive brain in different stages after so many days. So you can really see how the brain is affected by this disorder.
Right. I wanted to bring that up because I saw this quite a while ago on a documentary film. And then when I was watching the Frontline special a couple of weeks ago, they actually brought this particular scan into question. They said it's promising, but it's not proven science yet. What is your take on that?
I saw that special, and for example, the scans we have in our books, they basically show the metabolism of glucose. It has to do with the activation and the neural transmission. So increased activity for manic, for example, severely decreased for depression. But in terms of those scans that say, well, we have a scan that can show a cross-section of brain activity, that in fact provides an accurate diagnosis, that's far from being validated at this point. There are a number of companies and researchers working on it, but it's not very accurate at this point. Mm,
so you say it's promising, but not very accurate.
Right.
Okay.
I know I worked at a psychiatric hospital 10 years ago, and we had a group of people coming in, neuropsychologists, who were emphasizing we could eliminate your psychologist testing, all the testing that used to be done just by having these scans. That was 10 years ago. So there's increased effort, but nothing has been so strongly validated that it's been proven to be that useful.
Yeah, well, the brain, I mean, we know so much, but so little about the brain still, right?
Right.
Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how we deal with this with family members. And there's been an increase in diagnosis with children. So I want to look at that too. So please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we'll be right back.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Howard Bono, the host of The Money Thing, heard right here on Tuesdays at noon. You don't need to know everything about money, but there are some things you really should know. Each week, my co-host Gary Mance and I will bring you the information that you need. We cut through all the verbiage and marketing hype to provide you with an hour of condensed, easy-to-understand information. We want to improve the quality of your life by taking the financial stress away. So join us for The Money Thing, Tuesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk 1150.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guests today are Dr. Bernard Golden and Nancy Rosenfeld. Together with Dr. Jan Fawcett, they wrote New Hope for People with Bipolar Disorder. And I wanted to look in this last section at what's happening with children, because we are seeing a rapid increase in kids being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And we've kind of gone from the ADD to ADHD, and now bipolar seems to be quite prevalent. So what is going on?
Right. There was a study done that was released in September of 2007 that emphasized there was a 40% increase in diagnosis of children and teens with bipolar disorder. I think that's happened for a number of reasons. Children have behaviors that are not quite the same as adults. They show some of their depression by irritability, or even the mania by irritability, restlessness. And there's such a range of behaviors for children that are different than adults that can be comorbid, meaning they may have a different diagnosis, but they show some of the signs of bipolar disorder. So increasingly, it could be a developmental problem. It could be ADHD, like you described, but there are a number of symptoms. Mm. Diagnosis of bipolar disorder is based on history, and so, in fact, children who may be diagnosed, there is a long-term history, although some infants, even in the early months, are seen as so energized and agitated, for example, that they may get a diagnosis at that age. Another problem, again, with diagnosis is I saw a study several years back, and this was consistent, that out of medication used to help people with emotional difficulties, 75% were being prescribed by primary care physicians rather than psychiatrists and those who study that every area of emotional difficulties. And so it may also be used as a medication for management of children when, in fact, it can be helpful, but at the same time, it may be misdiagnosed for that same reason.
Yeah, and I guess my big question on that is is how do we determine normal brattish behavior in children, especially in teenagers when, you know, hormones are going wild, and maybe even poor parenting skills?
That's why it takes several years to get an accurate diagnosis. Especially with teens, and even the bipolar becomes most evident in late teens and early 20s. But especially in teens, besides, like you described, hormones running rampant, there's such a fragile identity. There's such a fragile sense of self. The child or teen has still not really learned self-soothing skills. How do you deal with disappointment, frustration? And so they're much more vulnerable if there's a pre-genetic disposition to have reactions that can lead to evidence of bipolar disorder.
Vicki, it can also be a very tough diagnosis to swallow when you're told that you have bipolar disorder. It can be very, very frightening.
Mm.
But books such as ours have helped to eliminate so much of the stigma. And not only, but a lot of very prominent people who also have bipolar disorder have come out of the closet, so to speak. One such example of a powerful personality is Judge Saul Walker, who was on the threshold of becoming governor of New York, his cherished dream, and then instead he became Saul Walker, federal prisoner assigned
right.
to solitary confinement. And in fact, Alan Dershowitz, who I mentioned in an op-ed piece for the New York Times, he said Saul Walker was not a good judge, he was a great judge. But there are so many other people who have come out. Mike Wallace from 60 Minutes and Kathy Cronkite and Tipper Gore and going way back, Mussolini, Alexander the Great, Oliver Cromwell, so many people. So when I say I feel like I'm in good company, I've been twice blessed, I don't feel the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
I have accepted my condition and have learned to turn lemons into lemonade. And it's so possible to do this. If I can do it, other people can do it.
Right.
And we show you how.
Yes, you do. And I want to just go back to talking about the kids' diagnosis one second, because I want to just talk about medication and children. Because as I understand it from the research that I did, the medication has not been particularly tested for children. Is that correct?
Many medications are not as well researched as they are for adults. And as with medications in the past, they then go ahead and try them with children to find some positive effects. One of the studies, for example, about antidepressants for teens especially, a while back, indicated that there's increased likelihood of suicidal ideation. And what that study really emphasized was instead of 2%, there was a 4% with certain antidepressants. There are several issues regarding that. One, for example, is when children or teens are given antidepressant and there might be bipolar disorder, it actually makes them more manic. And so anyone being prescribed antidepressant, that has to be closely watched for any kinds of signs of behavior like that.
Right.
They've put warnings on antidepressants, and in the last year or so, there's been a decrease in prescription for antidepressants for teens. Lo and behold, there's an increase in suicide rate and attempts. And so we have to look at the cost and benefits of medication.
Mm.
Clearly, if there's been an increase, it also suggests people are not getting the sufficient or proper medication.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of factors to weigh into this.
Right.
Nancy, as far as family, when you have bipolar disorder, what does your family need to know? What do your friends and coworkers need to know?
Well, they need to know what is happening. They need to get in touch with your doctor and to be very much involved in your care, because they have to be able to look for the symptoms. If you're living with a family member with bipolar disorder and that person is getting a little bit too manic-y and may not be aware of this could be trouble. And family being so close can be very helpful. And also, if you're getting too depressed, I mean, there were times that I didn't want to get out of bed, and I just kind of pulled the covers over my head, and I didn't. I could have stayed there had it not been for my family, who encouraged me to get up. Mm. It was another day. So family must be involved. They must be in tune. They must know what's happening to you. And that's why we encourage them to speak to the doctors and read, educate themselves, know what's going on.
Right. You talk a lot about a sense of loss, because you have this sense of losing your sense of self-identity when you first are diagnosed. You talk about being compassionate, and you talk about self-compassion in the book. What do you mean by self-compassion?
You have to like yourself. For others to be able to like you, you have to appreciate yourself. And when you're so low on the totem pole, it's pretty hard to like yourself, because you're feeling no sense of self-worth. Everything is bleak. You don't like what you're doing. You don't like how you look. You don't like how you're acting. You don't like how you're speaking. You look into people's faces, and they don't like, they look like they're not liking what they see either. Mm. You have to learn to think more positively about yourself. And this is all part of therapy.
Right.
And it's also, this is where the support system comes in too, because your support team helps to encourage you. So your ultimate goal is a improved sense of self, of yourself.
Mm.
I can't.
Go ahead.
Can I elaborate on the self-compassion element of it? In terms of compassion, we emphasize being aware that we suffer, that everyone suffers. Second part of compassion is that we want to help reduce that suffering. And the third part is we do something to help reduce that suffering. So with self-compassion, it's really our ability and willingness, being open to acknowledge suffering that we're experiencing, building up a sense of wanting to take care of ourselves more effectively, and then taking action and being supported by family to do that, in contrast to families that sometimes internalize the stigma or are against medications or dismiss the bipolar symptoms as this is just a temporary thing. So it's really that element of self-compassion as well as compassion for the individual.
Mm. It used to be called manic depressive psychosis. Is that why they changed the name? Because they felt there was too much stigma attached to that bipolar disorder?
That was the older term, and I think that's one of the major reasons for that.
Mm.
I think it had a lot to do with stigma, too.
Okay.
Bipolar disorder is a little softer than manic depression.
Right. And I read, I think it was that suicide is more likely to happen with bipolar patients. I think it was like 7 or 8 times more likely to happen. And you talk about new medical strategies for suicide prevention, and obviously that's a key factor if people are feeling suicidal. So what are some of those new strategies?
Emphasizing that people talk about suicide, family members, again, if there's stigma attached, they don't want to hear, and they may become oblivious to signs of suicidal ideation. So talking about it, talking about listening to a client, if they talk about, well, I'd be better if I wasn't here, I want out, a worsening depression, a sudden switch from being sad to being very calm, certainly
As Dr. Fawcett also says, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Mm. Mm. But I'm guessing if they're in a really bad state, somebody's in a really bad state, they don't, you know, my neighbor committed suicide, and I couldn't for the longest time get my head around why he would take such a choice. But, I mean, it was his choice. when somebody's in that bad a state, they're really not thinking rationally, are they?
No, you're not. You're not at all thinking rationally, and it's actually a very selfish thing to do, because you're hurting so many, many people around you, but you don't think that way.
Right,
you
right.
think I'm in just ultimate pain. I cannot go on. Everything hurts. I mean, your head hurts. Everything hurts, and everything looks bleak. You feel hopeless and helpless, and there's no reason to go on to tomorrow.
Mm. One of the precipitating events very often for someone with bipolar disorder is not just the depression, but when there's agitation with the depression, or agitation/anxiety, the person wants to escape that very visceral, intense anxiety. So while it is depression, it's not just that. It's a combination of those factors.
Okay. Of all the emerging therapies and medical treatments that are coming out, Dr. Golden, what are you most excited about?
The combination of new medications that are helpful, like I say, the anti-epileptic, the ones that also medications that used to be used with the schizophrenic population have been extremely effective. That the antidepressants are having less of a sedative effect, so that's a major issue for people who are trying to carry on with their lives. And then these new behavior psychotherapies, also focusing on specific aspects of living with and managing depression.
Yeah, I read in the book where you talked, one of the case studies that you shared was somebody who did not want to get out of bed in the morning. They were worried about taking on a new job, but am I going to be able to handle it because of the sedative side effects?
Right. A major. Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
That's a major challenge. And one of the difficulties is helping clients work around that, often by, if they can, ideally finding a flexible work setting that will allow coming in late or changing hours. That's sometimes hard to come by, as we all know, but mm-hmm. I encourage clients, if they have it within them, to find some work where increasingly people are working from their home, finding something they can do.
Yeah.
Or taking medications later in the earlier evening rather than right at night. There are a number of factors that have to be looked into.
Okay. And Nancy, in 30 seconds, because we're running out of time here, but what do you know now that you wish you'd known when you were first diagnosed with bipolar? What do you want to leave our listeners with?
What do I know now that I had wished that I had known? The importance of family. I nearly lost my family along the way because I became so engrossed in my work, and I was so sick, it precipitated everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just keep your priorities, stay balanced. Always try and self-monitor yourself.
Okay, sounds good. And Dr. Golden, what's, again, 30 seconds, what do you want to leave our listeners with?
The emphasis on new hope. I do a lot of work on an outpatient basis, and I used to work more in psychiatric hospitals. And I see people who are more stabilized, but once they are stabilized and the new therapies are helping them,
okay.
There's a lot of ways to help them manage this this very challenging issue.
Great. And if you'd both like to give out websites for yourselves, and then we have to close the show.
Okay, I have one website, angermanagementeducation.com. One long word.
Okay. And for Nancy?
Well, I'm a literary agent, and my website is aaabooksunlimited.com.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. And I thank you both for being with us today and sharing such great information with our listeners. I thank everyone else for tuning in today. Thanks for being with us. You can reach me at 800-495-7617 if you have feedback on today's show. That's 800-495-7617. Or you can email me at Vicky@conversationslive.net. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong, and please join me next Monday at noon for more Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Be sure and tune in next Monday at noon when Vicky talks to Julie Matthews. Julie Matthews is committed to health, healing, and the happiness of all things. Her latest work is the accumulation of 7 years of study into the impact of food and environmental toxins on the health and brain function of children. Tune in for Nourishing Hope next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. For more information, see conversationslive.net. Views.